This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to Lady Swindlers with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. This series, we're on the trail of swindlers, hustlers, and women on the make. We'll travel back in time and across the world to discover their crimes, uncover their motivations, and get to the truth of their lives. Now, I suggest you buckle up tight because I have a thrilling story for you today. Fast cars, fabulous houses, a media frenzy, an eye-watering fortune, and a fake heiress.
Motor car mystery. The accident on a Welsh cliff. Search for missing lady.
I am Violet Charlesworth.
£150,000 to be given to her when she was 25 years old.
The girl who has had adventures that are without number.
Yesterday, fishermen and boatsmen were searching the sea, but the body has not yet been found.
We're off to North Wales to meet Miss Violet Charlesworth, an Edwardian young lady living a life of luxury. And we're asking, what would you be prepared to do for fame and fortune? And what would you do if it all starts to fall apart? It's the 2nd of January, 1909. It's a clear, moonlit night near the village of Penmyne Mawr. Violet drives east along the coast road, wearing a striking crimson cloak. She loves cars, the speed, the rush, the power. But then, all of a sudden, the steering wheel starts to pull and tremble in her hands.
Mon chea elwyr baw de cythral. Cochodd the Violet reolaeth in a place called Demon's Turn. Violet lost control of the vehicle, which suddenly swerved to the left and crashed through a wall. A piece of the wall collapsed, and the vehicle went through the gap. It stood within 18 inches of the edge of the cliff.
Violet's two passengers are shaken, yet unharmed. But the driver herself is gone.
Violet was thrown from her seat behind the wheel, went through the front glass of the car and over the edge, falling into the sea below.
But if that's true, where is Violet's body? The water is calm and very shallow. She can't have been washed out to sea.
A tam o'shanter and a notebook were found on the rocks. That was all.
Ooh, now that is tantalising. We have clues. A notebook and a tam o'shanter. That's a sort of Scottish beret type thing with a little bobble on the top. I'm thrilled to be joined by someone who, like me, enjoys a good mystery. She writes historical fiction, crime fiction, and graphic novels. She writes for stage and screen. She's an all-round megastar storyteller. It's Denise Miner. Hello, Denise.
Hello, Lucy.
Now, Denise, you are a Scot, but I can promise you that you're not just here for your expertise in tam o'shanters. We also need your crime-solving capabilities. Are you ready?
Yes, I'm ready. I have a pen poised.
Fabulous. And completing our investigative trio today, of course, it's our wonderful in-house historian, Professor Rosalind Crone. Hi, Ros.
Hello, Lucy. And hello, Denise.
Well, let's get into this. Welsh historian Eileen Thomas went to the crash site to tell us more.
I'm standing at Penmyne Bach, which is just off the A55, the expressway that runs along the coast from Ynysmon, the island of Anglesey, to Chester. And it's reported in the newspapers that the twist in the road we can see in the distance where the crash takes place is known locally as Bawd y Cythral, which loosely translates to demon or devil's turning. This is quite a sharp and dangerous road. On that day, Violet and her older sister Lillian had been for an afternoon tea at a hotel in Bangor, and they were returning to their family home at Llanelwy, or St Asaph. Violet and her family moved here around 5 years earlier, in 1904, but already she is making a name for herself. She's donated silver cups to local shooting competitions and football tournaments. The reaction to Violet's crash is fascinating, really. Initially, the Welsh language press are very sympathetic.
Hanes trychineb erchych ydoedd i ddechrau. Ac yr oedd gofid dwys y meddiannu pawb wrth feddwl am y fath farwolaeth ofnadwy ddaeth i ran y ferch brydmer.
We have words like trychineb, which means disaster, and erchyll, which means horrible. Journalists seem to be genuinely deeply saddened by the thought that such a beautiful young woman has met such an awful end. But within a few days, there is a very clear change of tone.
That's right. Almost at once, people start to notice that there's something not quite right about this crash. There's no blood at all on the car or on the rocks. And her family don't seem at all anxious about finding Violet's body. As for the car itself, the windscreen is broken on the driver's side, but other than that, it is, to all intents and purposes, undamaged. The headlights and the mudguards are good as new. Now, Denise, this doesn't quite stack up, does it?
Why is there no blood in the car? It sounds staged.
Do you want to know more?
I really do. Who was she?
Roz, what could you tell us?
Well, Lucy, if we go to those two items found on the rocks, perhaps strategically placed, Denise, these are reflective of her interests and her personality. So first, that tam o' shanter, Violet is obsessed with Scotland and anything Scottish.
To be clear, she's not Scottish, is she?
She's not Scottish, no, she's English. She rents a country house near Inverness and decks it out in wall-to-wall tartan.
No.
Not so sure about her taste. She also has an auto piano that plays Scottish airs. So kind of like having a Scottish playlist on repeat these days. And she buys bagpipes and has her photo taken dressed as a piper. And I've brought that along for you to see.
Oh, my goodness. She's wearing a kilt. She's got buckles on her shoes. And how would you describe that little hat she's got on there?
Oh, that's your typical kind of...
A piping hat?
Yeah.
Denise, help us out here. What do people
Is
wear
there such
on their
a
heads?
Thing as a piping hat? I don't know. Walter Scott invented Scottishness, so it's all fake.
Ah, so, good point.
But sometimes Scottishness abroad is very peculiar, so I don't know what the hat is.
She is as fake Scottish as Queen Victoria.
Interestingly, you know, the idea of being obsessed with somewhere that's quite far away and at that time would have been constructed as quite posh, you know, sort of John Buchan kind of country. It's a lot of social signifiers she's sending up. So I think she's saying she's rich. Does that sound right, Roz?
Yeah, absolutely. The important thing is this is all part of Violet creating a particular image. She's this kind of wannabe Edwardian influencer, right? If she had an Instagram feed, it also would have featured high Edwardian fashion, the most luxurious hotels, expensive furs and diamonds. You'd also see a lot of dogs. She loved dogs, particularly those big St. Bernards.
She does sound fabulous, though. Doesn't she? Huge outfits, massive dogs, lots of cars.
And what do we think about the mystery notebook, Roz?
The notebook is actually Violet's motoring diary, and she records every journey she does in it. They publish excerpts in the newspaper at the time. And if you look down, you'll see that the destinations include places like Stafford,
Sheffield, London. And this is very Violet. She's been to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Violet is driving a lot, sometimes late at night, sometimes all alone. Wasn't that rather racy, Roz, for an Edwardian lady?
Yes. In the Edwardian period, most women's lives are still judged and shaped by a set of highly gendered expectations. Women are seen as weaker and more vulnerable than men, and they are really expected to marry and have children. But in the late 19th century and early 20th century, a small number of women are starting to enjoy greater independence and autonomy, greater access to higher education and the possibility of a professional career. Some women even wore trousers. They rode bicycles, and even better, some, like Violet, drove cars.
The swiftness, the power, the ease, the sense of command woke in me feelings which it is almost impossible to explain. The motor car was to me a thing of life. I think the poetry of the machine affected me.
And they all became packaged up in this idea of the new woman.
The new woman.
The new woman in the 1890s. And the new woman was typically middle class, independent in mind and body and finance.
Okay? Wow.
And we can see that in the woman that we have before us, right? She has money and financial independence. She even speculates on the stock market. And her stockbroker reports that she has a very masculine grasp of business.
The new woman sounds like she is a feminist then, Roz.
Yeah, well, at least some, not all, were feminists and feminists of their time. And of course, there was a backlash, as many believed that these independent women threatened the natural order and this could be disastrous for society.
Denise, people have accused you of being a feminist writer. How dare you?
Yeah, I mean, even when I started out 25 years ago, every interview asked you if you were a feminist because feminism was a bad word at the time. I mean, it was all new lad culture and all that kind of thing. And, you know, it's still an ongoing moral panic. I mean, it really never stops.
Crime fiction is a genre that results in order being restored. There's perhaps a conservative message there. How does it accommodate feminism?
That's really interesting because crime writing, because it's a low art form, it really wasn't policed for gender at the very beginning. So many of the Golden Age writers, the dominant Golden Age writers are women.
Of course they are. Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, Marjorie Allingham, that lot.
Yeah, it does have quite an egalitarian history, actually, because crime is a sort of point of conflict, social conflict. It's a very interesting place to talk about those things. You know, the woman who is not listened to quite often is the detective, or the woman is very often a victim. And you can talk about them in the restoration of order. It's not the restoration of the status quo. It's the restoration of order and it's justice.
Let's go back to Violet, our new woman then, who's disappeared in a way that sounds exactly like the setup to a crime novel. The public is glued to this story.
The original supposition that the lady was thrown out and fell or rolled into the sea is practically abandoned.
The new theory is that she's run away. But what or who might she be running away from? Well, it now emerges that Violet has borrowed a lot of money from a lot of people. She has funded her lavish lifestyle with loans. At the time of the crash in January 1909, Violet owes her stockbroker £10,000. Now, that's roughly equivalent to £1 million in today's money. But rather more disturbingly than that, she's also borrowed money from individuals who can't really afford it. There's old Mrs. Smith, a widow, and one-time neighbour.
I was simply taken in by them.
Mrs. Smith has lent Violet and her mother over £400 over several years. That's very nearly her entire life savings. Then there's Violet's ex-fiancé, Dr. Edward Hughes Jones. He has lent her about £5,000, a huge sum.
I was honestly and deeply in love with her.
They broke up over her extravagant spending. But why would these people lend her so much money? Well, it's because they believe that she's going to be very rich very soon. For years now, Violet has been boasting, I'm going to be fabulously wealthy. I'm going to inherit a magnificent fortune just as soon as I turn 21. Oh, sorry, no. When I'm 25, that's when I'm going to get my money. Until then, Violet says, her trustees hold the purse strings, so she just needs to borrow something to tide her over. She looks like a good bet, doesn't she, to make a loan? I mean, look at her fabulous cars and her jewels and her houses. And she's so well connected. Her godfather was the legendary Victorian soldier, General Gordon. She knows people. But now, less than 2 weeks before her 25th birthday, Violet has disappeared. Roz, just days before inheriting that vast fortune.
Yes, that's exactly right. The crash happens on the 2nd of January, 1909. And Violet turns 25 on the 13th. But it soon becomes clear that, in reality, Violet is going to struggle to pay back the huge amount she has borrowed. And in fact, for the last 2 months, a private investigator has been on her case. And on New Year's Day, 1909, the day before the crash, she is served with a summons for default.
She has disappeared at a very convenient time.
Yes.
Naughty. Eileen Thomas, our Welsh historian, went to the Charlesworth family home to find out more.
I'm in a restaurant and bar called Bod Erw in the village of Llanelwy or St Asaph. People are eating, drinking, enjoying themselves. The staff are quite busy. But in 1909, this was a private house. It's an elegant country mansion with 6 or 7 bedrooms, a coach house and quite extensive, beautiful gardens. For the Charlesworths, socially, this is a big step up. The family, Violet, her parents, her sister Lillian and her brother Fred, have moved around a lot in the past. They lived in Derbyshire, in Stafford, in Wolverhampton. And they've always lived in rather modest terraced houses. They certainly weren't well off. And the move to Llanelwy itself raises questions and eyebrows, with people questioning really how an insurance agent like Violet's father could afford such a lavish home. Immediately after the crash, while everyone is still searching for Violet, at Bod Erw, the family barricade themselves in and they're refusing to talk to anyone about Violet's disappearance. There are crowds of people outside the house every single day. Looking through the very windows in front of me now, there are curious members of the public, two women using a ladder to try and get through an open window. You've got boys trying to deliver telegrams, journalists, and most importantly, perhaps, Violet's creditors. They are starting to call in her debts. Law enforcement are also present. They're trying to enter the house to seize her belongings, and the family hold them off for around 2 weeks until the Sheriff of Hill makes quite the dramatic entrance with police officers scaling the walls in the dead of night.
With the family barricaded in their home and Violet missing, her 25th birthday finally comes round. Violet herself is AWOL, of course, but are solicitors and trustees trying to work out what to do with her riches in her absence? No. It becomes abundantly clear that there is no inheritance. This was a bogus fortune. Violet was a fake heiress. Whew. Now, Denise, we know that there was no way that Violet could pay these staggering debts. I can't help making a comparison with... Do you remember the story of Anna, the fake heiress? Anna Delvey, or Sorokin, as she really was, who lived in New York and conned a lot of people.
Yeah. Money comes to money, they say. Anna Delvey said she was a Russian billionaire, so she got a lot of credit. She just kept saying she would pay it later. And actually not paying her debts became part of her shtick. It's the future payoff con. It's a way of, you know, making something out of nothing. But it is finite. I mean, the big mistake that Violet has made is giving a deadline. That's fatal.
Roz, in this case, it is true that Violet is not acting alone, right?
Yeah, that's right. From the evidence we have, it looks like the mother, Miriam, initiates the hoax when Violet's just a teenager.
It really reminds me of the Kardashians, because with the Kardashians, the mum very obviously decided to make this a business, and she's kind of selling her daughters as influencers. The mum is presenting the daughter as the front stall, but the mum may well be at the back of it.
Well, Violet is still missing. But I think I might be able to hazard a guess as to where she could have gone. What do you think, Denise?
If I was tracking her, yeah, I would go to Scotland.
And funny this, just a few days after the crash, a woman calling herself Margaret MacLeod checks into her hotel on the Isle of Mull. And then, guess what? Fragments of a telegram are to be found in her room, addressed to none other than Miss Violet Charlesworth. But the woman has already left on a boat to the mainland. She leaves her hotel bill unpaid and she snips her name out of the guest book. There's great excitement across the country at this point. Violet has been found. But hang on. Remarkably, Margaret MacLeod gives an interview to a national newspaper from a hotel in Oban, and she's adamant about her identity.
Of course I am not Miss Violet Charlesworth. I have no objection to saying who I am. Margaret Cameron MacLeod.
You have, of course, seen the statements in the newspapers about Miss Violet Charlesworth?
I have seen some of them. I've been much amused by the wildly differing places at which she is supposed to have been seen. I understand from the papers that she is a very tall girl.
I replied that those who knew her described her as about 5'6" or 5'7".
And I am only 5'5" and a half".
Denise, did you enjoy Violet's Scottish accent?
She's fabulous. And also, she's giving interviews. How extraordinary. The real unspoken part of this story is the newspapers are everywhere. They are swarming around like ants in the summer. Everybody bought 4 or 5 newspapers, particularly in Scotland at that time. Violet on the Run is the best possible story.
Now, Roz, how long do we think Margaret MacLeod can keep in character?
Oh, well, the very next day, Margaret has a sudden change of heart and decides that she is, after all, Violet Charlesworth. And her plan seems to be to take control of the story and cash in on her newfound celebrity. Now, others were cashing in first while Violet was still missing. And I brought some things with me to show you. So there's the Daily Express from the 14th of January. And they say that you could buy Violet postcards at 3 pennies each.
Excellent. In 6 different costumes.
Yeah, 6 different costumes. Okay, next, Violet wrote songs. And you'll love the title of this song. It's called Goodbye Girlie. It's printed in the newspaper and it was being licensed to music halls. Now, Violet then starts to cash in. Daily Mail pay her £400 for a sit-down interview. That's a lot of money. Then the Weekly Dispatch publish across 3 weeks. Look up there. Story of My Life. Mm. There's also a melodrama in London. They actually create inside the Hippodrome the cliff road coming down the hill, and they have the car driving down and going over the edge, and they create the sea out of a big tank of water.
Does she do a roly-poly down into the tank? That would be great.
Yeah.
Does she get a film deal?
Yep, that's the next thing that happens. She does get
she
a
does.
Film deal.
Yeah. She doesn't.
You think this is the early 20th century. Silent film deal. And there is the film written up. It's called, wait for it, The Welsh
Gone Girl.
Cliff Mystery. No.
Gone Girl. Not
no.
Gone Girl.
And guess who gets to star in the leading role?
Violet herself?
Violet herself.
Brilliant.
The leading role.
Well, she's a good actor.
Yep.
What a turnaround then. So she's gone from a woman on the run to being somebody with major earning potential.
I think she's lost her mind because she's going to get done for all this. And she's basically providing evidence over and over again and reinforcing the story. I think she's very young. I think she's dazzled by the money, but the celebrity. I mean, there is something really intoxicating about being looked at. I think people often think celebrity is a defence, but sadly, as someone from a legal background, celebrity is no defence when it comes to criminal cases.
Unfortunately for Violet, her stage career is short-lived. She experiences terrible stage fright and she actually gets booed by audiences before she packs it in altogether. It's established that Violet owes at least £12,000 to individuals and companies for goods and services, plus £12,000 more in stock exchange liabilities. She's officially declared bankrupt. And then, a year after the phony crash, Violet and her mother Miriam are arrested and they're charged with fraud against Mrs. Smith the neighbour and Dr. Jones the ex-fiancé. They're examined at the police court and subsequently appear before a jury on the 23rd of February 1910. Violet goes on insisting that there's some truth to the claims that she's made.
It was while I was 17 that I met the man for whom I had a great love.
She's talking about a man called Alexander MacDonald. He's from Melbourne, Australia.
For many years, he had been very fond of me, and he asked me to marry him.
She says that he promised her £155,000 on her 25th birthday.
I have been disappointed.
But nobody can find any trace of this Alexander MacDonald. There's a bit of laughter in the courtroom, with the judge insinuating that the victims have been rather gullible. It takes the jury just 20 minutes to find both Violet and her mother guilty. They get 3 years in prison and their attempted appeal is dismissed. Violet is released on licence in 1912. And what does she do? Of course, she returns to Scotland. And there's no more record of her. From then on, she simply vanishes. What do you make of her, Denise?
I think she's amazing, and I think quite sinister. I mean, 3 years isn't a lot for that amount of money when you think about the damage that did. And I think they're laughing about it in the court because everyone wants to believe that they're special and they wouldn't be stupid enough to fall for this. But actually, you would, and that's why people need it to be funny. But I think the papers are quite kind to her in lots of ways. And, you know, as long as you give them great copy, they will soften the harms that you have caused because you're providing endless column inches. To a certain extent, she did fulfill her gender role. She was husband seeking. She was familial. She was local. She was pretty.
I think it's also interesting that the judge in Violet's trial said at the very end that she was obviously a woman of great talent, that she might have had a distinguished future if she had properly applied her ingenuity. But when I read that, I thought, really? How? Because Violet wasn't well-to-do. In reality, she wasn't middle class like your archetypal new woman. She came from a humble background and her opportunities were limited.
I think it's obvious. We're just on the cusp of the golden age. The world was her oyster. She should have become a detective novelist.
She should have. Brilliant.
If there's one thing that Violet Charlesworth had in spades, it's gumption. I wouldn't be at all surprised if we were to discover one day that she went on to live a long and outrageous life as somebody else altogether. Perhaps somebody Scottish. Violet was hungry for riches, for fame, for attention. And to get these things, she took advantage of new freedoms. But she did it in a way that wasn't good for other women. Violet's story confirmed a lot of people's worst fears, that empowered women can be dangerous, even criminal. However, and I do admit that this is a begrudging and conflicted respect, but I do have quite a lot of respect for Violet, actually, for driving herself forwards in a world made for men. A huge thank you to our guest detective Denise Miner, historical consultant Rosalind Crone, and location historian Eileen Thomas. Next time on Lady Swindlers, we're joined by journalist Helen Lewis to discuss Women Who Dare. Lady Swindlers with Lucy Worsley is produced by Sarah Goodman, and the readers are Claire Corbett, Ewan Vaughan, and Jonathan Keeble. The executive producer is Kirsty Hunter, and the commissioning editor is Rhiann Roberts. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4, and you can catch up with the whole series if you search for Lady Swindlers on BBC Sounds.
Ist deine Haut heute schon geschützt? Der UV-Index ist aktuell besonders hoch. Deshalb braucht deine Haut jetzt vor allem eins. Zuverlässigen Sonnenschutz. Denn 90% der Hautalterung entstehen durch Sonnenlicht. Testsieger laut Stiftung Warentest ist die Eucerin Oil Control Gelcreme mit Lichtschutzfaktor 50+. Sie ist ultraleicht, zieht schnell ein und sorgt für einen 14-Stunden Antiglanzeffekt. Außerdem ist sie wasserfest und schweißresistent. Ideal für heiße Tage. Mit dem Code SUN20 bekommst du jetzt 20% Rabatt auf alle Eucerin-Sun-Produkte bei shopapotheke.com. Nur bis zum 31. Juli.